Hello, and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer. And with me is someone who, he got a new truck. It's not an ordinary truck. It's an orange truck from the government.
Yeah. I don't know. If you're like a slave to the state, I guess you got to be happy with any sort of good news, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I am currently tied to my house with a ribbon, but so is everybody else in America.
Oh. Yeah, there's
pretty
a
tough.
yeah, there's a yeah, so this episode is a secret special episode on the recent it kind of was like a indie hit a little bit last year, I Am Not a Witch by Rangano Niani. Okay, I have the name right there. And she's a Welsh and Welsh-Zambian filmmaker. And after I heard about this movie, I realized we should probably cover it. Because it's an African movie, I'm going to cover as many as we can in our runtime. So I brought on someone, I think one of two people that I know who has actually seen this movie, Ben Sunday.
Yeah, happy to be here. Happy to be part of that rarefied group of people who have seen this movie.
Yeah, so, Ben, how did you first hear about I Am Not a Witch?
Well, it was actually part of a series at Brattle Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, sponsored by Natalie Portman. She actually came and presented the films. I was not lucky enough to see it because I was out of town at the time. But then the film came back to Brattle Theater like maybe a month or two later as part of the Women in Film series. And that's when I happened to see it, and I fell in love. So it's me, it's Natalie Portman.
I can't remember how I first heard about this. Maybe on BBC Africa podcast. They interviewed, already talked about it. But I can't remember how I first heard of it. And it's one of those, I hope it's on streaming, but it's an African film, so it's kind of 50-50 shot if it even will get distributed outside of Western Europe and in Africa. But yeah, I was surprised it came to Amazon streaming, and I mostly like it. It's just kind of, I don't know, it feels, kind of falls a little flat for me, but I still, the second I've seen it, but I still do enjoy this movie. I also just wanted an excuse to talk about a more contemporary African film, because before we talked about Mbeti, like Toki Buki, which like everyone knows about if you're into like foreign film, but like I kind of want to get into more contemporary stuff. But, Joel, did you know about this movie before I told you we're doing this?
Negative. Never heard of it.
Oh, interesting.
In fact, when you mentioned it, I kept making jokes because we covered something on High and Low, which was... What was that? I keep making that joke.
An Innocent Witch.
An Innocent Witch, yes.
It was one of the final Ghost Show movies. He was one of the guys from, like, the 20s? Things first when he worked Ozu in like the mid-20s, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it comes to movies where one person may be a witch and one person may not be a witch, I believe that I'm firmly in the I Am Not a Witch. Was she a witch? I don't know. You know, some mysterious things are going on. But in the Innocent Witch, that person definitely was not a witch and probably shouldn't have been treated the way she was. Now, this movie, I think, is excellent for people who don't realize that children often are magical beings and should be tied to ropes.
That's a ribbon, not a rope.
Yeah, that's an odd takeaway. But
I'm taking a strong stand on abusing children when they are supernatural.
Mm. Okay.
So, like, those first sweet parents... They had every right to lock Harry Potter underneath that staircase.
Well, you see all the trouble he caused.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it should have been slightly larger, but, you know, they were in the rest. I'm just kidding. Did we lose all our listeners when I just made a...
Yes.
I hope nobody thought I seriously was saying that somebody should tie up their children in any sense, other than one of those leashes. You know, because they're just going to run out on the road if you don't have one of those leashes.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah, like toddler leashes are real. They should be used. I have a lot of younger cousins and shit, so like I've seen them in action. They are useful.
It's three parts of essential things you need. You need the toddler leash, you need the toddler face masks so they don't bite people, and the toddler taser for emergency situations.
Yeah. So I am not a witch. Ben, you're more passionate about it than I am. How would you sum up this movie?
Does it specify the setting? Is it Ghana or Zambia?
I think it's Zambia because they mention Lusaka. Lusaka.
Okay.
Very briefly.
All right. Well, it takes place initially in a Zambian village where the young lady of mysterious origin, I don't know how old she is, like maybe 7 or 8, she's accused of being a witch and brought to a police officer who then leads that young alleged witch being grouped with a bunch of other alleged witches by a government official and used for fun and profit until tragedy or some sort of miraculous event befalls her.
Yeah, and like this feels like we talked about Atlantics earlier, late last year, and this kind of falls in that category a little bit, where it's like the mix of magic and the real, but Atlantics is more explicit with like magical realism, and this is kind of like, is it magical or is it just, or did it just happen? It's more left up in the air.
Right. It definitely verges on magical realism, but there's enough ambiguity there that you could explain everything. It's just happenstance.
Yeah, that the mixture of like this, like I feel like Atlantics took a kind of a possible story that would have been made up in an older time and brought it into a modernized story with the, right, you know, the skyscraper being built and stuff like that. But this was like, from what I was looking at the Wikipedia article, which I know is just I can't help it. If it's my ultimate source of knowledge, I never went to school like a regular person. I was raised in a cave with the internet. And it says that the witch accusations and camps like that are a real thing.
Right.
Which is distressing.
Yeah.
It is. Like with that, it feels like there's some ongoing tension between modernity and old world folkloric beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like this was maybe like 3 or 4 years ago in Tanzania or Mozambique, it's around that region. Like there was a man who gave like 50 or so women AIDS without realizing it. Because it clashed with like a, because it dealt with, because it wasn't right for anything. It was just like a cultural practice that was he was participating in, and so like the government was having a real tough issue of like, do we arrest this guy for giving women AIDS or like do we not, like how do we punish him because like he was just following like traditional like practices. So like. And like this brings up that in a bigger way. It's like, having witch camps and profiting off of witches, and but like there's clearly, I don't know. Like, would you say there's clearly a struggle in the movie of like the characters being like the people in power realizing how stupid it is, or do you think like the Guardian.
Not so much the people in power, but like a broader cultural sense that this person may not be a witch and questioning it. Though the people in power are the ones who profit most from her, so they have the most vested interest in relegating her to witch status rather than affording her basic human rights.
Also, this movie doesn't seem to play as if anyone doesn't believe that witches are possible. Like, sure, the police officer in the beginning is kind of like, okay, this is just a little girl and you guys are all freaks, but she calls the government person. It's like, well, we got a witch situation here. What do you want to do? And he's like, oh yeah, definitely. I know exactly. And I realize, you know, they're getting free slave labor out of this. They're making money from tourism, people visiting and stuff like that. But also, it's never in question as to, like, well, of course, we just have a little girl. The only person who, like, seemed to be a voice of reason was a person we don't see whose voice we hear over the phone when he's on TV. You know, like, why isn't this little girl in school? Like, well, everyone else thinks she's a witch. What's your problem, dude?
So do you guys want to do, like, a summary from beginning, or are we just...
Talk around it. Because there's, like, a couple major events, but it's just kind of, but there's not, like, enough plot heavy stuff to really... But, all sorts of negative, sure, I guess. But, like, to me, this movie is touching on the whole lot, but ultimately to me it just comes off as like it feels kind of slight and like it's not as deep as it thinks it is at times. Like I can't really explain it beyond like it just feels like the big scenes where it's like they're not so subtly telling you like what the movie's about just kind of leave me like okay, but like I feel like there's more to say but it's not being said.
Well, like, what would be an example of a scene like that?
During a TV show thing where, like, he gets embarrassed and just kind of ends on that, just kind of like, because it starts out embarrassing and it gets even worse where it brings up, like, why do you have this child? Why aren't they in school? And it's kind of just ends. It's like, I feel like there's more there that could have been mined, but it kind of leaves me empty.
Yeah.
I can't really
explain. I mean, the whole movie is a series of like these little vignettes that like we don't know how much time is passing or whatever is going on. Like we're just getting these glimpses. There's no firm explanations or anything like that. So I don't feel, I mean, would you wanted that scene to be longer or for there to be somebody who actually was like, you're doing the wrong thing? And
I don't know. Just like this, like all the vignettes just kind of to me feel like, I don't know, half baked, but like they're like the it's clear thought out, but like this feels like this kind of leave me like okay, but there's like I don't know, it's just like I don't know, it's this empty like and kind of slight. I can't really explain it beyond that. And
if I were to overanalyze that scene, I could say that the person on the phone was actually us. Watching this movie, watching this TV show, where we're like, this is ridiculous. Why isn't somebody helping this little girl kind of thing? But, I mean, that just occurred to me right now. Like, I don't know if that was the intention of the filmmaker. But that's really the only time in the movie where somebody is like, hey, that's a kid.
Yeah,
I don't feel like it's a film that exists to make an argument against this practice, this cultural practice, because I feel like it's just sort of taking it for granted that the audience will see it and recognize that it's wrong. Like, just the title itself is like, I am not a witch. It's like a firm assertion of the fact that this child is not a witch, and that assertion is never actually made within the film itself, and I feel like that's because it's simply a given.
Okay.
And that it doesn't need to be, you know, one of those problem pictures, that it can instead concentrate on character a bit and you know, setting and like building a world more so than making a sort of political argument.
Okay, yeah, I see your point. It kind of feels slight in like the little girl, I said her name, Maggie Mulabwa, like she, like her performance, it gets better as it goes on, but like in the beginning, I know criticizing child actors is a weird thing to do, but like I don't really, I don't know, she seems kind of not as, like she doesn't know what she's quite doing in the beginning. Like she seems confused, but maybe like, it's more confusing like a given performance, but as it goes on and she gets more is more just deeper into a situation, then it turns into she gets better and better. It just like it kind of feels uneven a little bit.
Well, I feel like she's a perplexing character in a lot of ways, because you would think that at the outset she would simply say, "Hey, I'm not a witch, guys. Leave me alone." And if she had done that, apparently like that would have been enough to convince the police officer that this was not a real case and that she should just let it go. Like, it actually isn't even until Banda hears that she's not denied that she's a witch that he gets really excited. It seems like he probably gets a lot of calls like this and doesn't give them much mind, unless it has that special factor of the child, or in most cases it's probably an adult woman, not saying that they're not a witch, like not denying this. So, I mean, just on the fact that alone that she doesn't issue a denial, like that makes her sort of mysterious and inaccessible to the audience. That to me sort of explains her performance at the earlier parts of the film before she even speaks.
Joel, you're a stickler for child performances. What do you think of her?
I thought she was great. So. I mean, what kind of acting does she really have to do? I mean, she acts like a child in that situation. The only time we see her showing any sort of boldness is when she kind of starts to think she does have powers during the second time when someone is accused of. We don't really know what's going on, but it seems like it's the same situation with the grandpa with the rad old McDonald ringtone, where they're at some hotel. It's like, which one of them did it? Do you want to call? You want to call the old lady again? Like, no. Like, she's got this like sureness in her eyes. Like, mm-hmm. I can tell just by looking at them now.
Yeah.
And whether or not this is true of her or not, she shows a confidence in just in that moment that she didn't have before. And then I think especially when she starts to realize how bad it could be for her, like after the woman who is the whatever the bureaucrat's like wife is almost getting stoned just by trying to go to a grocery store, it's like she starts to fold in on herself, and like I don't know, it seemed very much like somebody who maybe even younger than she is would be acting. I didn't like the song and dance number when she was singing, what's it called, something on the Ritz? I can't remember. That didn't make any sense in context in the movie.
Yeah.
Putting on the Ritz. Boom. Educated.
Yeah, I just realized this kind of up front, like, as always, like, what movies it reminds me of, to help, like, figure out my feelings on stuff, but, like, I feel like it's kind of like The Elephant Man a little bit. Only I don't think Dave Lynch's Elephant Man is as overtly political. Although I haven't seen that. I've only seen clips of it. Never seen it. But like it.
Sure.
But
it's also a story about a person who is sort of at once revered and stigmatized, and like the tension between those two things.
Yeah, and like the people that she thinks are helping her. Or supportive aren't actually supportive of her, because like at the end with when the other women are like talking to her through the tent about like just like asking like what's wrong, do you need anything, and like she says I wish I should have picked to be a goat, and like that whole scene feels like just like her before that she realized they were using her too, but. I forgot where I'm even going with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a fundamental yearning for basic freedom. Like, the Elephant Man, I guess you haven't seen the film, but, like, one thing that he wishes he could do is just lie down in bed like a normal person and go to sleep. Mm-hmm. But because of his condition, if he were to do that, he would die.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, Shula, she wants just the freedom to walk around without being tethered by a white ribbon in the same way that, like, a goat, something as simple as a goat can do.
Oh, yeah. Although, based off the other African films we covered with goats, that probably isn't a good sign.
Yeah, they do immediately say, hey, if you're a goat, they'd fucking kill you and eat you.
Yeah, and also like thinking of like Tokubuki, where you see a goat killed on screen. It's like, oh, like goat's a major food over there, and that's not a good thing. But like she's a kid, so like she wouldn't really understand that. And like watching it a second time, is like interesting. They choose goats and not like any other animal, like the animal that like is like the that is like is meat and milk and like that is as used. And not like, you know, like a leopard or whatever. Like she was like a farm animal that is, you know, consumed.
Goats have some satanic connotations to them, don't they?
Yeah.
Satan had feet and so forth, so maybe that was the more sinister animal that they could think of.
Yeah, and like no Black Phillip, like goats do have a certain association with like witchcraft.
I mean, they were talking from experience. They'd seen people cut these ribbons before and turned in goats, obviously, wasn't it? You know, it's like it's happened. When? Well, I had a dream, just like that one guy.
Yeah, like I assume that they sent her into that, you know, private room or tent to make her decision, so that if she did cut her ribbon and run off, they would say, "Oh yeah, she turned into a goat."
Got this truck full of goats. I'm just waiting for one of them to try to do it. And what am I gonna do with all these things?
In terms of similar films, have you guys ever seen Satyajit Ray's Debbie the Goddess?
He's a huge blind spot for me, still.
Sure. Well, I mean, that is a somewhat similar film in that it's about a new bride who's living with her father-in-law while her husband is away. I can't remember if it's for study or work, but basically the father-in-law has a vision in his sleep, so basically a dream, that the daughter-in-law is an incarnation of a goddess, and then he starts worshipping her, and then the village starts worshipping her as a goddess, and she's sort of thrust into this revered position where she's asked to adjudicate on issues and perform miracles and everything, but at the same time it's also a position of subjugation. Hmm. Like, she basically just wants to be the wife to her husband and live a normal life, but instead she's thrust into this role of a goddess that comes with a great deal of power, but also comes with a great deal of sacrifice on her part, and the tension inherent in that is very similar to the tension we see in this film.
I like that this touches on a whole lot of stuff. Like, I to like clear up my thoughts and try to process like why I feel about the way I do. Like it touches on like class, gender, economics, belief, politics, which are like huge, massive things to touch on, and maybe. Maybe it's because, like, maybe I feel a way about it because, like, I think maybe shooting a little too far, potentially, and it's like in scope, because like have because like it just at times feels like it's just trying to say way too much, but it doesn't, but not in a Spike Lee type of way where we're saying way too much, where it's like a giant fucking mess that's still watchable. Like, this is like a stripped down, but it's also trying to say a whole lot, but it's kind of a weird balance of like trying to be simplistic but then trying to have like a deeper meaning to everything. But I don't know, I'm strangling at this point.
Like, for me, the simplicity is inherent in the fact that it's taking place mostly through the vantage point of a young child who is in a position to be affected by issues like politics, gender, economics, and so forth, that doesn't have like an adult grasp of them. She only sees like the impact that they have on her immediate situation. And so, like, us as adults, like, we see that too, and we can infer the rest, but like in regards to it being her story, it makes sense to just focus on her experience.
Joel, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you were talking about how going through the plot beat by beat wouldn't really do much for the conversation because it's kind of not really plot driven anyways. It's a series of events from one end to the other. The conclusion being possibly the girl's death, although we don't actually see whether or not that's that person. I see what you're saying with the messages being crammed or a lot of messages being thrown out there, but it doesn't feel overly stuffed to me in any way. Like, I feel like it's kind of just they take one character and put her down in the middle of this situation, and all this stuff happens to be going on. But we, like I said, we're not getting an explanation as to like the history behind the situation or how to solve it or anything like that. It's just like, oh, this is messed up.
Yeah, like it's also like metaphorical for like because the whole like witch hunts thing was just like women that were out that were weird or lived alone or didn't want kids, you know, like in Europe and America, and like this is the same thing, and you could also apply this to like homosexuality and foreigners. Like it's a very open-ended, universal
like phenomena of stigmatism. Yeah.
Also I think maybe like the simplicity of it is also just to show, just like, Naomi, maybe her is like also having it be so simplistic and stripped down like that could just be like you can it could be a metaphor for like homosexuality and stuff like that because in Mar Africa is still like across the whole continent it's still illegal in most countries to be homosexual and like you can be thrown in prison and I think in two countries it's to get a death penalty still like it's pretty harsh and like and this is just like you know it's they aren't homosexual but they are you know women who aren't following the normal rules of society and so like these women are basically put in prison. They don't say it's prison, but it is a prison, and you know, it's commenting on like this being an outsider in society.
Well, you know, they don't. The witches in this are not executed, even though people are afraid of them.
But like, they are in prison.
Right, yeah, but they're also like a sideshow kind of thing. Like that's a different situation than it would be with like a homosexuality. Like nobody would be like, "Well, I can profit off of this."
That is kind
of
thing.
Like, I mean, they would have profited off of like the enslavement part at least in that kind of situation. But
maybe I read
the sideshow bit. Yeah, it's your fault.
Okay,
Spencer. No, I don't think your views are incorrect on it. Yeah, art can only be interpreted by the individual in the way that the individual sees it.
Yeah,
and I don't have like that much of a background in the phenomena shown in the film, but it is notable to me that the majority of the witches seem to be old, like often elderly women. It might point to, I don't know, them being widows or something, just being older women that don't have anyone to support them, and so they just sort of, like, exist on the fringes of whatever village, and that leads to them being accused of something, like, simply as a way to drive them out, or to remove them as a responsibility. Because that's a phenomenon that we see in other cultures, where if a woman, her husband dies, suddenly she has no source of income, like no means of supporting herself, she would become ostracized in some way or another. In India, there's a practice called sati, which is if a husband dies, then the wife is expected to throw herself on the pyre as a sign of grief as to what happened. Though more often than not, simply a way to remove her from the village so that she is not going to be dependent upon the husband's surviving family or the community at large. They actually had to formally outlaw that practice because it was so common. They would like physically throw the wife onto the fire.
Jesus. Yeah, and in northern Japan, Hokkaido region, I think it's where it was, like there's a common practice of when someone gets old enough and you can't take care of them, I think when they turn 70, you take them up to the top of the mountain to die. And there are a couple of movies about it. There's a really grim Imamura one, Battle of Noriyama, which is a remake of a 50s movie that's not as good, in my opinion. But, but yeah, so, like, you know, this is, you know, it's a common thing. It's just like, but also, like, some of those women, because like the, I don't think they're ever named. It's kind of like, it's more like a collective of like eccentric old ladies, more or less. Yeah. But like there's
like they're collectively known as Grandma.
Yeah, and there's the one who looked considerably younger than the rest, but I mean she looked 40, or others looked like 80. And like the when she like throwing rocks at her. her ex-husband or ex-boyfriend, and so like
whoever her accuser is,
accuser that. So like it could be family, you really don't know, but like that maybe right. Like okay, maybe she's a woman who won't put up with anyone's shit, and so they're like, oh, she's a witch, so they don't have to deal with her anymore.
Oh, definitely. And she's she's bitter about that in that thing, and like the lady's like, I don't care, you know. She's there to make money off of these people, which is even weirder. Like, these are slaves. How are you going to make money off of them? But, I mean, I guess she figured out a way. Can at least get some gin out of them.
Yeah. And they didn't drink the gin. Well, the one doesn't drink the gin.
Yeah. I was going to say something. Now I can't remember. Thanks a lot.
No.
Brain.
Did you guys like the music?
I'm not familiar with the classical song that plays... over the opening, and then recurs later on in the film.
They play a couple of different classic
the first one
orchestral
is,
things, yeah.
First one is Vivaldi. I think it might be Spring or Summer.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those two. And, that's also an old boy when Odesu is ripping out the guy's teeth. So I always think of old boy when I think of, when I hear that music. So, like, whole time in the opening, I'm thinking of like, old boy uses this too in a really graphic way, but the use of classical music was kind of odd. But like I don't think I've seen an African movie that used classical music, really at all. Because what we've covered, like Toogie Boogie uses that Josephine Baker song, like Perry. Or Paris, or whatever the fuck it's called. And, like, the other one use, like, music from the country, and this is the first one where it's like, oh, this is just, like, music, classical music, and it's kind of like an odd combination of images and sound that, like, I can't say I've really seen much of.
Yeah, I think it makes it sound in a good way, and it was used sparingly, like, it wasn't throughout using this classical music. I watched it with the not only the subtitles for the foreign language, but also the English stuff like that. And that like they were saying which piece was being played during those parts. I really liked the part where the woman was there trying to sell the wigs, because she was it was like Sim Kardashian and Rahana. Or something like that. Yeah, Rahana. You're familiar with the American musician, Rahana?
She's Caribbean.
Yeah.
I think she's Trinidad.
Yeah.
I think it might be Trinidad. I can't remember
what. Oh, that's what she says in the movie. She says the American musician.
Oh, yeah, okay. I thought you were being ignorant.
No. Okay. I mean, I totally am ignorant, but...
Okay. But, yeah, I did, like... Who else? There was like a Nicki Minaj one. It's nice, but that's a nice little joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it serves as a reminder that the events we're seeing transpire in the film exists concurrent with what's currently transpiring in our own lives. Like, while on the one hand, in this one part of the world, you have people all being enslaved as witches, and on the other hand, you have Beyonce and Nicki Minaj and so forth. Mm-hmm. These two things coexist. Existing, like, is like another example of the tension between like modernity and old world superstition that pervades the film as a whole.
Oh, I should mention, this is like maybe the fourth or fifth time we've brought Beyonce. She keeps popping up in episodes every so often.
I just bring her up in everyday conversation anyways. I don't didn't realize I was talking about her on the podcast so much. You gotta talk about Queen Bey.
Yeah, other music choice that stuck out to me was the use of Estelle's American Boy at the very end of the film, as you see those two men driving like an ox cart, and one of them is listening to American Boy over headphones.
Oh, yeah, I was trying to figure out what that song was. But yeah, I like the ox POV, sure. Ox cart POV. And going back to the wig thing, like, in the wig thing, like, that's one of the few times it's not from the perspective of Shula. And it's notable because, like, the way they're shot, it's like we are there and they're, like, looking at us. I guess it's so shot from perspective of the wig, lady. And so, like, they're, like, talking to her and looking at her, and it's, like, it feels weirdly personal. And that made me think of Hard to Be a God, because, like, that movie is full of moments. Have you guys seen Hard to Be a God?
No.
Oh, it's an oppressive, depressing movie that's I want to kind of experience. But, like, it's shot kind of like that the whole time, where it's like you are a character in this world of mud and shit, and like people and the characters are just like approaching the camera and looking at you and talking to you and shit like that. And although this is movie is not nearly as gross as that movie. It's basically Tarkovsky if it was like much more violent and disgusting.
I mean, it sounds great.
It is great, but. But also, like, adding to, like, the music thing, every so often there'd be, like, this avant-garde, like, jazz playing that, like, kind of, like, sounds the jazz, like, the drumming you hear in, that was in, Birdman, who's the other guy? Zach Galifianakis is in it. Batman, the old Batman is in it. Yes, that guy, and that one. Yeah, but some of the jazz, like, I don't think really fit. Sure. But, like, the classical music worked in well, but the avant-garde, like, weird jazz stuff was, like, it felt like it was trying a little too hard.
Yeah. I mean, if you watch a film that's made in and about an African nation, like, I feel like the expectation is that you're going to hear a score that is heavily influenced by, like, the local culture. Like, you would expect... like native Zambian or Ghanaian music. So yeah. I feel like there's a very deliberate choice not to go that route with this one.
Yeah, other than the ladies in the camp, you know, they were the ones who were singing anything that I would think of as a traditional music from that area.
Yeah.
But I did like the change in music, because but at the same time, like, the jazz felt like didn't, I don't know. It stuck out in a bad way. Where classical music stuck out in a good way.
I'm not really a fan of jazz in movie scores, Spike Lee. What were we talking about?
I mean, you could also think that the classical music may be standing in as like an example of the lingering effect of colonialism.
Oh, 100%.
Like, highly European style of music.
Yeah,
because the white people are not there. Like, there are some white people, mostly as tourists, I believe, like, looking at the witches, and then there's this other guy who I guess is doing some sort of test on the legitimacy of the claim that Shula is a witch, but like, for the most part, like, this is a formerly colonized nation that, you know, is still bearing the scars of colonization, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, the whole continent is kind of feeling that, because colonialism really fucked up the whole continent as a whole. So that's a discussion for another day. that could be a whole separate podcast talking about stuff. But like, the classical music, it showed up when there were tourists, usually, because it opens with like a bus passenger POV of a bunch of tourists going to a witch camp. And, like, the second tourist you see, because I think most of them are black, but you see this very, very pale, I think a little slight, like, this isn't meant to be mean-spirited, but overweight, like, bigger woman who is very pale and sticks out the sore thumb, and it's like, okay, this was on purpose to show, like, this white person here.
Yeah.
And have, like, you know, like, the quote-unquote, like, fat foreign tourists. like to to gawk at the witches.
Sure.
And I think when that and towards the end, where she's in the head, Shula is in, like in the head thing because she's punished or whatever. Like I think that's classic that shows up there again when the woman is like, "Oh, let's take a selfie. That'll make you smile." That really
horrible. And she thing. Offers to Shula later. Like Shula has a cell phone. She's just gonna give her Instagram address. Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't feel like the film is saying this problem of being of women being categorized as witches is like the fault of white people, but like there is a degree of complicity there.
I think the only time you do see white people, you did say was as tourists, and the one doctor who questions the validity of it is like, well, when will it rain? Which is like I kind of love every time Bonda was humiliated because he's such a great buffoon.
Yeah, it's hard to completely hate Bonda because he is like the actor does a good job of making the character a pure comedic.
That's like a I don't know if that's I'd call that a trope, but like there was a character like not exactly like that in Atlantics, but you know the big guy whose house that all the women went into. This is just another super rich guy who's a lot heavier than the rest of the cast. Like, maybe this is just a thing? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Because he was...
And, like, Bonda isn't that wealthy. Like, he's wealthy within the setting of the film, but...
Well, I mean, he lives in a mansion compared to what I've seen, but, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say he's necessarily rich or anything like that. He does have a super nice house, though.
Sure. And it seems like he's constantly having to hustle in order to, like, keep that up. Like, he's not just involved in the witch business. He's also selling real estate, right? He's trying to sell eggs during that one interview, which is great. Shula with the witch-branded eggs. They'll give new life to your breakfast.
That's
what I've been missing out on.
Yeah, the rapper Brisky, she is a real rapper, and I would love to maybe have her do like another verse. I really was enjoying the performance. Yeah, I like the trajectory of I always feel weird saying that word. The Shula's journey, cause like the first 20. Got text from family. Okay, I can ignore it. Because the first 22 minutes is she is silent, and then she says, because it's when she goes in a hut to when she's accused of being a witch at the camp, I think, when she says, yes, there's a witch in there, and that's the first thing she says. And like so she goes from this very silent, confused child into this propaganda, this living propaganda piece, and then she gets to have some sort of freedom because she gets to go to school and she seems to enjoy school. Like the few times you see her in class, and then she gets her quote unquote freedom, which it's never said because I do interpret the end as like that is her body being dumped at the field because why else would the old women react the way they do?
I agree.
And like how she died, who knows? Because there are like these weird workers that would chase down the women, so maybe they would kill the quote unquote goats. It's never explained, but like I do kind of assume like the teen like the younger men that work at the camps are the ones who like do all the dirty work because like there's other stuff going on at the camp, like they're probably beaten. There's probably more fucked up things happening there than the movie showing that Ben, you're saying like Shula, she like it's from her perspective, so like we don't see everything. We just kind of see it how it affects her. Are there any other big points you guys have? Like any other like scenes or like characters you want to bring up?
Yeah, Banda's partner, who is revealed to herself be a former witch, who through performing the duties that are expected of her, has managed to achieve what she calls respectability. Like, I feel like she's a very significant character because Shula opens up to her in a way that she doesn't to anyone else that I recall. And she, this elder woman, also sort of represents a positive trajectory that may be available to her. So it's the one time in the film when it feels like there's a degree of hope for this character that then, unfortunately, is shattered when we see that even this quote-unquote respectable woman still bears the stigma of being a witch.
Yeah, very Scarlet Letter.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a situation where the woman seems to, I mean, she's tricked herself into this, like, feeling that she is now different because respectability, because of marriage kind of thing. Because, like, it seems like she was probably younger than all the people that normally get moved in with these women. And, like, it was probably just a situation where he was like, hey, this is a beautiful woman. I could probably end up with her, you know?
Right.
And so he used it for that. And then that facade just breaking off when she tries to go shopping that one time is pretty intense. Like, as a kid, that would be terrifying.
For sure.
Like, I'm in a car alone. If these people, like, actually do something terrible and, like, kill this person, what's going to happen to me?
Right.
It's like, she's not safe, and she's supposed to be my example of, like, how my life could go. Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah, and that is the scene that precedes Shula sort of retreating into herself. They do that rain dance attempt afterwards, and she refuses to perform, even though prior to that she had been leaning more into the identity of a witch.
Okay, so the very end, where when it does rain, do you guys think it's based off the title, it's just nature, but or do you think it is magic? Like, where do you guys lie on that, on like the when it does finally rain?
Okay, I got two viewpoints. One, it's just nature, and it was going to happen, and it was like all this for nothing. Like, this child died, and it was just, the rain was just around the corner. The second viewpoint is the girl had to sacrifice herself to bring the rain. Like, she finally figured out how to give them what they wanted, and the only way she could figure out how to do it was to die. But, you know, that's me trying to, like, read any sanity or not even sanity, read anything into a bit more magical realism into the movie. You know, I think it's probably just supposed to be like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Now this dead body's soaking wet. Great.
Yeah, on the one hand, there's the question of how you interpret it as a member of the audience, and I feel like you could probably, like, go either way. But, like, to me, I'm thinking just about how the characters in the film are going to interpret that event. And to me, they're going to see it as, like, some sort of noble sacrifice on Shula's part. And unfortunately, that's also going to lead to the perpetuation of this practice, because it sort of legitimizes everything that's happened up until that point.
Yeah.
It legitimizes the treatment of the girl because it achieves the end that they wanted.
And the final shot of all the ribbons cut, like, do you think that is the... do you take that literally as the women escaped, or do you think that's purely is like symbolic, or?
It's a bit too artful for it to be like they literally all just escaped at the same time. You know, it's a really beautiful shot, and you can hear like goats bleeding in the background. I think it's, I mean, you're supposed to read something into it. I think it's a nice way to end the film.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily an event that transpires within the film, but more like an image of hope for like an indeterminate future point in the film. Like, maybe none of the women that we see in that camp become liberated, but, you know, perhaps someday this practice will end.
Yeah. Sorry, Kane. Messages. Yeah, it's kind of like the end of Female Prisoner Scorpion. Jailhouse 41 with not psychedelic, but like this pure, this fantastical ending of like all the prisoners escaping into Tokyo, and it's like a vision of like it, they can't escape even though you know it's all like nonsense, but the whole movie's like kind of like visual like beauty that.
Yeah, it's like the original end of Neon Genesis Evangelion, where everyone is congratulating the kid and... no, I'm just kidding, I don't...
Okay. But a couple other like specific things that made me think of other movies was when she pees on the... in the field, on the husks of whatever crop that was. It looks similar to the shot in Almodovar's Labyrinth of Passion, when there's this extended joke at the end where this woman has to poop and a bunch of people keep keep showing up and asking her questions and then she finally poops. But like it looks look like that shot. Yeah, I'm sure you guys have you guys seen Labyrinth of Passion?
No, but now it's number one on my list. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it's the first one he did with Antonio. Like Antonio is a supporting character playing a gay Arab. Suspiria, when they're talking to her through the tent at the end, it felt like the Suspiria when the mother witch, I haven't seen the movie in a while, are having a meeting or whatever towards the end. Okay, I just remembered something. And so like this ties into the American Civil Rights Movement a little bit. The only young witch you see is Shula the whole time, and that felt like this, like, because she's used as propaganda, and it's kind of like how the Civil Rights Movement, Rosa Parks was picked because she was an older, like, middle-aged woman, and she was, you know, like, had to, like, if you look at her, you would just see, like, oh, that's like a sweet old lady, more or less. And like, because the original choice they had for the bus protest was a teen girl, but she got pregnant. And so they realized they can't have like a pregnant teen be part of a protest because that will might backfire on them. But like, this feels like a similar thing of you can't have like a crazy old lady as like the witch we parade around the country. We need to have like someone that people will look at and have a certain perception of, and it's just like very purposeful. That's a weird little connection that I noticed.
Oh no, I'm still here.
Oh, you're taking a nap.
Yeah. No, I can't really think of anything else to contribute in regards to the film.
Okay. It reminded me of Sonic the Hedgehog. That one scene where wait, what?
Fonda is sort of the Dr. Robotnik of this film, isn't he?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So, this is streaming, and it's on DVD and Blu-ray, and this is very easily available. It's, this one too.
You think people should watch it?
Yeah, I think they should watch it.
Even though you hate it?
Yeah, yes, I hate this movie.
Yeah.
No, but I am curious what Naomi will do next, because this has my attention. Not to quote Django Unchained, but like this is a really good solid first feature film.
Sure.
I believe it's her first feature or one of her first, because she did some short films for this. But Ben, I assume you recommend it too.
Oh yeah, totally. Especially for anyone who's looking for an entry point into African cinema.
Yeah. Or, I'd say maybe Tuki Buki, but the animal death in that is kind of a big hurdle to get over. Have you seen Tuki Buki, Ben?
No, I haven't.
Okay. It opens with a slaughterhouse of a cow getting slaughtered. And it's very graphic. It does not hold back anything.
Mm. And then later you see the goat get slaughtered too, which is like, oh, well, as long as you get past that first part, like, oh, no. It's also, I mean, Tuki Buki is also a bit French New Wavy feeling. So if you are familiar with that type of film, it might not, and you don't like it, Tuki Buki might not work for you.
Yeah. But like,
this one feels like it's all softball, you know, like, yeah. even people that aren't crazy cinemaniacs might be into, even more so, I'd say, than Atlantics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is more accessible than Atlantics. Yeah. Atlantics is very. I don't like the term art house because I think it comes off as pretentious,
derogatory.
Yeah. Mm. But you know, it definitely is in that style. It's like it's, and this is like I Am Not a Witch is just a more accessible, easier to get into movie. But so Ben, have you seen other African movies?
Yeah, I saw Atlantics. I saw Rafiki last year. That was a very enjoyable one. It was about a lesbian couple. I can't remember what country
it was. It's Kenya. Because Kenya, you can go to prison for that. And the government had a real... there's a whole thing to look into with that movie and the Kenyan government. It's a pretty crazy story. But
Well, and that film is an incredible love story and also has incredibly vibrant cinematography. So I recommend checking that out. I believe it's available for streaming. Other films by the director are available for streaming anyway.
Mm-hmm. I've seen Chappie.
Yeah, that counts.
I was gonna say, does South African stuff count? Because I probably have seen a bunch of those.
Yeah. District whatever counts. I forgot what the number.
District 69.
Yeah, No. Whatever movie is called, that one counts.
Oh, did I watch the wrong movie?
Yeah.
Hey, if you enjoyed yourself, then it was the right movie.
Yeah.
Some confusion of the country of origin. Like, I Am Not a Witch was picked as Britain's movie for Best Foreign Feature. It didn't go through, but that's kind of like Z being picked for Algeria, but it's made by French money with a Greek director. So it's like, does Z count as an African film? Some people consider it African. I don't know if I would, personally, but sure, maybe. I don't know. The Academy considers it Algerian film. And this is kind of like, but I Am Not a Witch definitely does feel like, no, this is like an African film, African filmmaker. So like, even though, so I guess it's just British money. And that just might be the only reason. Because she's well.
I mean, that stuff is so convoluted. Like, who does it belong to, and things like that. Like, I feel like it has to come down to the people actually. You know, like not where the money came from, but the people actually producing the art. Not even producing, because that's a film term. The actual makers, the director, the writer, you know, the staff, where did they come from?
This is definitely a clear vision of an artist. Like, it's you can see like traces, like it's like any other movie, you see traces of where of like influences and stuff, but like this is a very clear vision, and I really do want to see more stuff from her. It's this is a very, very good, confident first feature.
Yeah, like you said, I want to see what the sophomore effort's going to be. I enjoyed this a lot, so.
She has a couple of short films, but yeah. And I don't know if those are available. I'm trying to look into those. Alright, so 2017? Yeah, 2017. Alright. Ben, you have a couple picks from 2017?
Yeah. The first one I want to recommend is a comedy horror film called Dave Made a Maze. Basically, it's about a young woman who leaves her boyfriend in their apartment for a weekend. It comes back and finds that he has, in the intervening period, built a cardboard maze solely within the confines of their apartment. A maze that, like the TARDIS from Doctor Who, is actually bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And he's actually gotten lost in this cardboard labyrinth that he's built for himself. So she has to assemble a party of friends and random people who've just wandered in to gawk at this oddity, and a NPR recording crew to go into the cardboard maze and find him. along the way, several of them die in surprisingly horrific ways, given that it's just a cardboard death trap. It's a very, very well-crafted film. The crew behind it was involved in things like a Lego movie and so forth, and basically every day for the duration of filming, they would assemble an entire cardboard set in the space of a studio apartment, film, and then tear it down overnight and build a completely new cardboard set. Lots of paper cuts and hot glue injuries in the process, but the results are very impressive. So I recommend checking that out on Hulu or wherever.
I totally forgot about that movie. It's not even... Is it on my watch list?
It should be.
No, I'll put it back in there, because I swear I had it on there.
Yeah, I've been meaning to see it for a while. When I saw a trailer, 2-3 years ago, I was like, holy fuck, that looks cool. But then it didn't come out for a little bit, kind of.
It's one of those that sort of slips under the radar, just due to lack of promotion. I happened to see it at a festival, and it was a real crowd pleaser there. Another film that I recommend is One Cut of the Dead. Have you guys seen that?
I have not seen it.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's one of those films where you don't want to spoil what the central conceit is, because it's a pleasant surprise. Yeah. But basically about a Japanese film crew, very ragtag, low-budget affair, filming a zombie movie, and then there's some twists that occur. But it's a good film if you're a person who loves film. Films about people with some sort of imagination that maybe exceeds their capability, but are still putting their whole heart into things.
Yeah. It's on Shudder right now, because there's a whole debacle of, Amazon had it on to stream, but then it was they didn't have the legal right to it, or there's some weird shit going on
before it was uploaded illegally,
I don't want to say too much about it, but if you listen to Shockwaves, this episode where Becca does kind of spoil it if you're into theater, because she mentions a certain play that's that copies the structure of. But I won't say the name of the play in case someone is listening is into theater, because they'll figure out what I'm talking
about. Is it The Book of Mormon?
Yes, The Book of Mormon.
Wow.
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 Last one I've ever had. Is Natasha Kermani's Imitation Girl. Are you guys familiar with that one?
Oh, yes.
That one's in my watch list.
Yeah, it's been on my watch list for a while.
Yeah. Basically, an alien life form crash lands on Earth and comes in contact with a softcore porno mag and adopts the visage of one of the nude models within it, played by Lauren Ashley Carter. And concurrently, you also see the actual woman, also played by Lauren Ashley Carter, go through her life as a porno actress who's maybe getting restless in that role and aspires for a little more. So you see these parallel stories of this one human woman and the alien that's adopted her form as they make their way through the world and eventually come together with some interesting results. If I could compare it to anything, I'd probably compare it to Under the Skin, but with a great deal more optimism and humanity to it. So if you walked away from my skin saying that was kind of interesting but deeply depressing, then you might look at Imitation Girl for something that tackles the same themes but with a much more humanism and joy.
Yeah.
Sure. She's a promising indie talent. We're checking out that film, and I'm sure her new one's great too.
Yeah. And speaking of Shockwaves, she's on episode Shockwaves. Because she's best buds with Rob G.
Yeah. He used to run Dread Central, the distributor. And that's the group that released Imitation Girl.
Mine are Revenge. It's the first rape revenge movie directed and written by a woman. And Coraline, French name, I'm going to say it wrong. Farget? I don't know. Anyway, it's it takes possibly the ugliest, most upsetting genre of film and turns it into almost like a popcorn movie over the course of the runtime, and it's kind of an amazing feat of like, oh, okay, like, Rape Revenge doesn't have to be like They Call Her One Night. It can be a fun movie and still have the same impact. It's just a great little revenge movie. I won't say too much about the plot, but you know to expect certain things, and like, it's not as graphic as some of the other ones. Yeah, it definitely is just a great twist on the rape revenge genre. And like,
one of the notable choices that it makes is not to depict the actual sexual assault.
I thought you see it briefly.
Yeah, you see like the initiation of it, but then it cuts away to footage of a third party just swimming in a pool.
Oh, yeah.
And he knows what's happening, but he chooses to ignore it.
Okay, yeah, I remember that now. Okay, yeah, and
that's one of the things that sets it apart from the other films in the genre. The fact that it doesn't use the actual assault as like exploitative fodder.
And does scrape the stuff with like symbolism of like having the woman be very feminine, and like she's wearing her earring,
star earring,
and they're pink, and it's like she's very girly, and it does a whole lot of it's very smart coding of gender and stuff like that.
Sure. Like, one of the notable things about rape revenge films, I think, is that oftentimes the thing that empowers the female protagonist is the fact that she sheds her femininity and becomes like a masculine force of violence. Whereas in this film, I feel like her getting revenge and becoming like a force for violence doesn't require her to adopt masculine coding. Like, she still dresses the same. She looks the same way. She's still like a woman. And she hasn't had to compromise that in order to stand up for herself.
Yeah, like, she's like, that symbolizing like her wearing the earrings the whole time. It's just like a great little visual symbol. But,
yeah, totally.
We're not here to talk about revenge. My other movie is actually a revenge movie, as realized. Killing of a Sacred Deer. It's Yorgos Lanthimos. If you like his dark sense of humor, you'll like this. And Colin Farrell's a doctor, and he was an alcoholic. Well, is, but he hasn't had a drink in a while, and he becomes friends with this weird kid who his father died when he was operating, when he was still drinking. And things get weird. And there's a very brief scene with Alicia Silverstone that caught me off guard, because, like, is that Cher? What's she doing in this movie? But, yeah, Killing of a Sacred Deer. If you like Dogtooth and stuff like that, or The Lobster, you'll like this. If you're not into a really dark, mean-spirited, like, if you're not into, like, hit Yorgos's, like, really dark sense of humor, you know, this could be, like, a bleak, unpleasant movie, but I find this movie to be hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really funny scene that it's, like, it's very, like, Emma Mora-type scene where, like, where Colin Farrell confesses something that happened to him as a child, and his son's reaction is not the reaction he's expecting. And it's so goddamn funny. It's very pornographers in that one moment. Killing of Sacred Deer and Revenge, both really good. Revenge is on Shudder, and Killing of Sacred Deer is streaming a bunch of places. J-Dog?
Alright, so I feel like everything I saw in 2017 is because it was super popular, or like First Reformed and You Were Never Really Here, which were never really here. I think I saw in 2018, but it was my favorite movie of whatever year I want to count it for. So the only thing, and I remember talking about Small Town Crimes on some podcast. It was probably ours, but I'm not sure. But that's a really good detective story starring John Hawks. Have either of you guys seen Small Town Crime?
I have not.
I think we talked about this when we had Justin Harrison on. We went on some tangent about John Hawks when he was on last time.
Yeah, that's all I'm talking about. Anyways, that's a really good movie. He plays a straight out drunk former police officer who gets involved in mystery, and he's just like, he's never not a drunk in the movie, but he is a good detective, so he starts getting around things. And it's got Octavia Spencer, Anthony Anderson in it, Robert Forster doing great stuff. Anyways, besides that, I'm going to talk about two. The first one is another one that I thought was pretty popular in 2017. Shockwaves, once again, was talking about in the movie Terrified, or Aterrados, by Damien Rugna, which is a horror movie that is ostensibly about documentary filmmakers. I don't think it's done in like a found footage style. But these people are basically hear about a haunted house situation where there's this crack in the wall, and where the people in the house have bad things have been happening to them. There was a child who died, and a really freaky scene where the kid just shows up again, and not like the kid actor shows up again, like the dead body of the kid shows up in their house. That's not really a spoiler, because it, like, what goes on after that point is just as messed up. But it's disturbing, and also has a dark humor to it that I really enjoyed. And I'm not sure how many people actually sat down and watched it. The cover shows this man who's split in half, that I think there is something like that for like 2 seconds in the movie. The CGI is not the strong point, but it does really good on a freaky atmosphere. And that was on
Shudder.
What were we talking about? Shudder. Yeah, it was on Shudder. I don't know if it still is at this point.
Could be.
Yeah. And the other thing I'm going to talk about is actually a series, season two of a series, although it's considered, I think they're both considered like separate mini series with the same characters. It's the second Top of the Lake series, China Girl. Now, Top of the Lake got a lot of acclaim, and it was, once again, a detective story. What is the name of that actress? Letterboxd is freaking out on me. What was that?
Is it Elizabeth Moss?
Or yes.
Okay, yeah.
Elizabeth Moss goes, she's playing a New Zealand person, I believe, and she goes back home after working on Australia, and basically she's trying to solve what happened to this girl who's missing in the first series, and things get crazy. There's like this kind of like hippie cult that's also part of the story that may or may not have anything to do with the mystery that's going on. That series is really good. China Girl, the second season or series from Top of the Lake, is insane. Like, I don't know if it's even by the same people, but it's got Nicole Kidman in it playing, you know, doing great Nicole Kidman work as usual. But
then Killing of Sacred Deer.
There's some stuff that happens in the episodes that like had me and Sarah with our jaws like on the ground. Like, is this really part of the story? Is this like a dream that's happening? No. There's just some crazy ass shit that happens, and it's like so. It was so enthralling. Like, I'm really sad. It seems like they're not going to do any more Top of the Lake stuff, and that makes me really sad. But if you watch the first and for some reason didn't watch the second, definitely watch the second one. And if you haven't watched either of them, check out the whole series, because it is super good. It's super dark, so if you're in a bad place, I might leave that alone. But, like, it's, I don't know, it's really entertaining.
Oh, yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, so do you have any stuff?
I'd be sure to write a very thoughtful dedication to me.
Yeah, yes, I will. No, but do you have any, are you going to go and be on Kill by Kill or anything like that in the next month or so?
No. Pending projects, but you can go ahead and check me out on the episode I did about Ran and the episode I did about Summer of Sam on your guests' podcasts.
Alright, and you might, and you will be on the next season, which, I won't do official announcement still, but if you follow me on Twitter, you kind of know what the next season will be. And, that's it. Oh, also, listen to other Seeker special episodes, like the Pam Grier one. That was a whole lot of fun. Timbuktu, the first one we did, Jackie Brown, let's go back and listen to those. And, that's it. See you guys for, Clockers and or, Underground.
All right, stopping.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.